Welcome back, my friends. You are listening to Follow Me Into the Dark, and I am your host, Michelle, of course. Thank you for joining me today. So today we are talking about the Black Dahlia. This murder goes down as one of Hollywood's most infamous crimes, and it's definitely one of the most sad and gruesome for sure. This is a story of a young wannabe Hollywood starlet, one with ambitions and possibilities, a story of a young life snuffed out too soon, a story of a killer who got away, and decades of theories, but still no conviction or no resolve. So let's begin. On the morning of January 15th, 1947, a mother taking her child for a walk in a Los Angeles neighborhood came across a disturbing sight. What she saw was the body of a young, naked woman sliced in half. The body was laying a few feet from the sidewalk, and posed in such a way that the mother actually thought it was a mannequin at first. There were extensive mutilation and cuts on the body, but there wasn't a drop of blood at the scene. So this indicates that the young woman had been killed somewhere else and dumped here. Her body had also been washed clean of evidence. Her intestines had also been removed, and her mouth was slashed from ear to ear to create a terrifying clown-esque smile that's also known as a Glasgow smile. Now, a little side note about the Glasgow smile. The Glasgow smile was a practice that originated in Glasgow in the 1920s and 30s among street crooks. Gangs would often use it on others as a warning not to mess with them. They would use razors commonly, and they used it to create this smile. So those at the wrong end of that razor were inflicted with a cut from one or both corners of their mouth, sometimes all the way to their ears. The victim's screams of pain only served to tear the cuts open further, resulting in a terrifying scar that marked the wearer for life. Just in case you needed to picture what that looked like. Now, the investigation was led by the LAPD. The FBI also helped, and the body was identified pretty quickly. In just 56 minutes, actually, they got a blurred fingerprint, and they used something called a sound photo. I looked into this. It's pretty much just like a old school primitive fax machine. The young woman turned out to be 22-year-old Hollywood hopeful Elizabeth Short, later known as the Black Dahlia. Now, there's a number of theories about where that nickname came from. Some say it was from the media. Others say that Short's friends nicknamed her the Black Dahlia. Most accounts say that the inspiration came from a movie written by Raymond Chandler that hit the theaters 1 year before the murder. It was called The Blue Dahlia. So why switch from blue to black? The FBI cites a rumor that Short wore a lot of black clothing, but some say it comes from her dark hair color. Now, her fingerprints actually appeared twice in the FBI's collection. And interesting enough, there were actually more than 100 million fingerprints on file at that time. Okay, so her fingerprints. They show up, first of all, because she applied for a job as a clerk at a commissary on the Army's Camp Cook base in California in January 1943, and they showed up secondly because she had been arrested by the Santa Barbara police for underage drinking 7 months later. The Bureau also had her mugshot in its file and provided it to the press. So as soon as the corpse was discovered, the Los Angeles Herald Express and the Los Angeles Examiner took full advantage of this tight relationship that the newspapers had with the Los Angeles Police Department. At the time, it was also very common to see suicide notes and bloodstained bodies on the front page, even though they were airbrushed and altered. And her naked body Somebody edited a blanket. They superimposed a blanket over it, and they would do that as well. Suicide photographs even added arrows showing how victims had taken their final fall. Now, the Black Dahlia case was actually front page news for 35 days. Now, the Examiner also kind of made some stuff up. The media never does that. They changed what she was wearing. The last time she was seen, she was wearing a black suit, and they changed that up and said that she was wearing a tight skirt and blouse. So they tried to make it more naughty, you know, sex sells, right? You know, another thing that's pretty shitty about this is the newspaper, they lied to her mother. So they wanted some background information. When they found out who it was, they found her mother and they contacted her. And they made up this story about how Elizabeth won a beauty contest and they wanted to fly her out to LA. And then they told her the real news, that her daughter was dead. So that's shitty. That's super shitty. Just so you can get information, you lie to this poor mother about her dead daughter. Anyways, so despite the obsession, countless theories, more than 50 suspects, many bizarre confessions, and it's over 70 years later, and this case is still unsolved. Now, some say that her murder was a result of a date that turned violent. Others say that she was broke, she was hitchhiking, which was a common practice back then, and she must have just gotten into the wrong car. But let's go back. Let's learn a little bit more about who Elizabeth Short really was. Elizabeth Short was born July 28th, 1924, in the Hyde Park section of Boston, Massachusetts, to Phoebe Mae Sawyer and Cleo Short. She was the middle child of five girls. Her family relocated to Portland, Maine for a while and finally settled in Medford, Massachusetts, where she grew up. Her father did pretty well providing for them up until 1929 when the stock market crashed, and that left him broke overnight. So the following year, his car was found abandoned on the Charlestown Bridge. So everyone just believed that he committed suicide and jumped into the river. Apparently they didn't look into it very much. They just find his car and they're like, oh shit, I guess he jumped. Anyways, so here the mom is left with kids alone. She's now a single mom. She moves to a small apartment in Medford and started working as a bookkeeper. So Elizabeth suffered from asthma and severe bronchitis, and she even had to undergo lung surgery when she was 15. And in order to avoid the cold, she had to live with her relatives in Florida during the winters. And she would spend the rest of her year in Medford. She had to drop out of Medford High School in her sophomore year because of this condition. Now in 1942, surprise, surprise, her father's actually alive. He reveals that he's still alive and living a new life in California. So at the age of 19, she moved from her hometown and went to live with her father in Vallejo, California, hoping to pursue her dream of being in the movies. In early 1943, they moved to Los Angeles and she managed to get work in the Camp Cook Post Exchange, now Vandenberg Air Force Base, near Lompoc. She didn't stay long and left after a fight with her father, moving to Santa Barbara. It was there that she was arrested for underage drinking and sent back to Medford. Over the next few years, she moved around Florida, occasionally going back to Massachusetts for visits. She would earn money by working as a waitress at various restaurants, but she was still often broke. Now, she was a young, pretty girl, had a lot of admirers, men that would buy her meals, buy her clothes, buy her gifts. Now, people who knew her described her as courteous, soft-spoken, a girl who didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't swear, although she was caught drinking, remember that. But anyways, she had aspirations to be a star. Her lust for life meant she frequented nightclubs. She loved the music and was always surrounded by men. During her time in Florida, she met Major Matthew M. Gordon Jr. on December 31st, 1944, at a New Year's Eve party, and they fell in love. He was part of the 2nd Air Command and involved in training for deployment in the China-Burma-India operations. While he was in India, he wrote her and proposed marriage. She accepted, but then, sadly, he died on August 10th, 1945, in an airplane crash before he could return to America. Now, it was later mistakenly reported that they actually already were in fact married and had a child who died. Gordon's family denied any connection between him and Elizabeth Short following her murder a few years later. In July of 1946, Short visited Long Beach, California, to see an old boyfriend, Lieutenant Gordon Fickling, who she had met in Florida during the war and who she kept in touch with. In the 6 months prior to her death, she moved frequently, living in various situations, houses, hotels, apartments. She never stayed longer than a few weeks before moving on. She was even known to have shared a cramped two-bedroom apartment with 8 other girls in Hollywood from November 13th to December 15th in 1946. Fickling's last letter from Short was dated January 8th, 1947, a day before she was last seen alive. And in it, she told him that she was planning to move back to Chicago, or to Chicago, to become a fashion model. On January 9th, 1947, she returned to Los Angeles to meet her family after a trip to San Diego with a married salesman named Robert Manley. Manley dropped her at the Biltmore Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, where she was supposed to meet her sister. The hotel staff recall seeing her using the telephone. The last place she was seen was at the Crown Grill Cocktail Lounge on South Olive Street, about a half a mile from the hotel. Now, it's also rumored that she was seen at the Cecil Hotel prior to her disappearance. There's not a lot backing that up, though. But that's out there as well. Now, this brings us back to the day that her body was found. At about 10 a.m., January 15th, 1947, Betty Bursinger saw what she thought was a discarded mannequin in a vacant lot in Leimert Park, Los Angeles, that turned out to be Elizabeth's naked body, severed in two. Betty ran to the nearest house and called the police. That area was quite underdeveloped and deserted, so it took some time for the police and media to arrive at the scene. Now, like I mentioned before, she was identified by matching her fingerprints with her previous police records when she was arrested for underage drinking in 43. The corpse was laid on the ground, face up, with hands stretched above the head, and the mouth slashed from ear to ear with that Glasgow smile. The lower half of the body, from the waist downwards, was placed a foot away with legs wide apart. The autopsy report put down the cause of death to be severe concussion and hemorrhaging from lacerations on the head and face. The time of death was estimated to be during the late evening of January 14th to the early morning of January 15th. The body was severely mutilated with cuts all over and superficial tissue loss from her right breast, meaning skin was cut off of her right breast. That's what that means. There was ligature marks on her neck, wrists, and ankles, and her anus was dilated, which indicated that she may have been tied up and raped. Okay, so I started going down the rabbit hole in my research of post-mortem anal dilation, you know, because why not? Yeah, so I won't go too far into this. It's definitely some of the strangest research I've gotten into so far on this show, but I will say that there are other reasons for dilation of the anus, and these findings are pretty much dismissed as hard evidence nowadays, so it doesn't necessarily indicate sexual assault. Unless there's other contributing factors that can be, you know, looked at as well, but that's not necessarily hard evidence of rape. So just so you know, if you want to know more about postmortem anal dilation, by all means, go ahead and dive into that yourself. So moving on, another thing about her body was it was apparent that the lower half was separated after her death and deliberately laid out in the manner that it was found. Now is the challenge of the detectives to unravel this morbid and confusing murder. On January 21st, 1947, the editor of Los Angeles Examiner received a phone call from a man claiming to be the killer of Elizabeth Short. He congratulated the newspaper on their coverage of the murder and followed it up with a letter that contained individual letters cut out and stuck to read, "Here are Dahlia's belongings." The envelope contained her photographs, business cards, and birth certificate. Another package received by the paper contained a handbag and shoe that claimed to be Elizabeth Short's. The evidence was handed over to police, but they could not confirm any fingerprints from their records. From the manner in which the body was sliced into parts, one theory is that the killer must have been a surgeon. There was a $10,000 reward for any information leading to the killer of Elizabeth Short. Over 150 suspects were questioned, and many false confessions were made in order to get that reward. However, all the leads ended up in a dead end. There are rumors that said that she worked as a prostitute and that she had infantile genitalia, but there is absolutely no proof of that, and who knows who started that rumor. And yet others say that she was a lesbian who got men aroused and left them high and dry. And again, who knows what the source of that rumor is either. It could have just been some guy who got all worked up over her and she shot him down, and so then he got all pissed off and held a grudge over some blue balls. So who knows? Now, some link the case to the Cleveland torso murders. When Short's death became national news, police officers in Cleveland felt an awful sense of deja vu. Between 1934 and 1938, a serial killer had terrorized their city, claiming 12 victims, all of whom were grotesquely dismembered. Some think that the Ohio serial killer and Short's murderer could be the same person, especially since, like Short's killer, the perpetrator of what came to be known as the Cleveland torso murders was never caught. It was also connected to a lipstick murder. 1 month after Short's murder, another woman's body was discovered in Los Angeles, and the circumstances were similar to the Black Dahlia's case in a few ways. It all began with a stranger, in this case a construction worker, stumbling across a naked body of a dead woman in the grass. Her name was Jean French. She had dark hair, like Elizabeth Short's, and her face was also badly beaten. But this time, there was an unusual message scrawled on her stomach in bright red lipstick. It said, "Fuck you, BD." Just below that were the letters TEX. People were quick to think that BD stood for Black Dahlia. The police weren't really quick to connect these two, and this murder was never solved either. The Los Angeles Times puts the tally of false confessions in Short's case at more than 500. The phony claims came from housewives, clergymen, soldiers, drunk ramblers, and much later, pranksters who weren't even alive when it took place. The FBI files on the Black Dahlia case indicate that many men were held for questioning, and some even took polygraph tests, but ultimately no one was ever charged with her murder. Still, a few names stand out. Over the decades, endless names have been suggested as the Black Dahlia killer. From the absurdity of an accusation against Orson Welles to the very possible Leslie Dillon or Walter Bailey, who I will talk about later. But dozens of suspects have been analyzed at length. Let's go through some of these. Let's start by talking about Red Manley, the married salesman. Elizabeth Short was last confirmed being seen with him. He dropped her off at the Biltmore Hotel on January 9th, 1947. Law enforcement checked his alibi for January 14th and 15th. It was solid. Manley was released and remained helpful to the police, even identifying Elizabeth's belongings. Now, Manley later died after spending decades in a mental hospital for an accident in 1986. They also suspected a man named Mark Hansen, who owned a nightclub and was known to have made sexual advances on Short that were rejected. There's also Dr. Patrick S. O'Reilly. According to reports, O'Reilly met Elizabeth Short through Mark Hansen at parties that they all attended. When investigating him, the authorities learned he had a history of sexual violence. He was convicted of assault with a deadly weapon for an attack on his secretary. O'Reilly took his secretary to a motel with plans for sex. When she refused, he began to sadistically beat her almost to death for no other reason than to satisfy his sexual desires. Again, he was not completely cleared. Others think it was a bellhop. Another popular name for suspects is Leslie Dillon. He appears in the FBI case files, but he got attention again in 2017 when an author by the name of Pew Eatwell argued his guilt in a book called Black Dahlia, Red Rose. The 27-year-old, a bellhop at the time of the murders, became a suspect in 1948, a year after Elizabeth Short's murder. Leslie Dillon read a story on the case in the October issue of True Detective magazine and shortly after wrote the LAPD psychiatrist, Dr. Joseph Paul DeRiver. After continuing correspondence between the two, Dillon declared he believed he knew who the killer was, and he named a guy whose name was Jeff Connors as the suspect. However, the psychiatrist, DeRiver, began to believe that Connors didn't even exist, and that Dillon actually had a split personality. So under one of the personas Dillon had created, he committed the murder and was actually the man that the police were looking for. This is what DeRiver's theory was. So along with undercover officers from the gangster squad, DeRiver set up an unauthorized meeting with Leslie Dillon behind the back of the LAPD officers that were actually investigating the case. And he did this under the ruse of going in search of this Jeff Connors. Now, during this, Dillon allegedly revealed several details about the Black Dahlia case that was never made public. So after what finally looked like a promising lead, problems arose when it was discovered that Dillon was in San Francisco at the time of the murders. And in another revelation, it turned out that Jeff Connors wasn't a figment of Dillon's imagination, like the psychiatrist thought. He was a real person. So I find that kind of funny. Wouldn't you think that would be the first order of business in this whole scenario? Like maybe you look first and see if this Connors guy is real before you go on some elaborate secret undercover mission? Anyways, Connor, his real name was Arthur Lane. And he lived in L.A. at the time of the murder, and he had worked at one of Elizabeth Short's known hangouts, which led Dillon to genuinely believe that he was a possible suspect. So in further embarrassment to the investigation, Dillon had been interrogated outside of official channels, and he was kept in a room against his will. And at one point, he actually wrote something down on a piece of paper, and threw it through a window, and it said, "Help, help, I'm being held prisoner." So his illegal detainment did not go down well. Basically, the investigation of Leslie Dillon was a huge fuck up, and this all was a huge contributing factor in an inquiry into the handling of the entire Black Dahlia murder that was ordered before a grand jury in 1949. Furthermore, Dillon later sued the city of Los Angeles for $100,000. It's not clear whether or not he actually got that payout. There's no evidence to prove it either way. So who knows if he got his money. The most recent theory surrounding Leslie Dillon is that he was a part of a gang that would rob hotels. The manner of their operation was that one of the gang members would obtain a job as a bellboy, locate the safe, and then quit. A few days later, the gang would then rob the hotel. Now, Elizabeth Short was close to a member of the gang and even lived at his home for a little bit. I had mentioned him before. It was a guy named Mark Hansen. He was a nightclub owner, and one theory is that he had her killed because she knew too much about the robberies. Elizabeth stayed with Mark Hansen on and off from May to October of 1946. And there is a record of the two of them having a phone conversation on January 8th. Hansen's name was on an address book that the supposed killer sent to the press. Mark Hansen was never completely clear of the crime, but he seems like an unlikely suspect. So Hansen, according to the theory, had a number of corrupt officers in his pocket, which allowed Dillon and Hansen to get away with murder. Despite being a suspect himself in the early investigation, it should be said that there was never any proof that he had anything to do with it. He was just he had no criminal record. He was a law-abiding citizen. So now, according to that author, Eatwell, that I mentioned, that published that book in 2017, stating that Dillon was the killer, Elizabeth was murdered by Dillon at the Astor Motel, where he often stayed, according to Eatwell. Eatwell also claims witnesses at the hotel saw a dark-haired woman matching Elizabeth Short's description at the motel, and that the owners found a room covered in blood and fecal matter on January 15, 1947, the day the body that Elizabeth Short was discovered. A couple of problems come up with this, though, with Leslie Dillon as the killer. First, there's no real evidence that he even knew Mark Hansen or Elizabeth Short. Second, Leslie Dillon had absolutely no surgical or medical knowledge, something which has clearly been stated throughout the investigation that would be required to carry out that bisection of the body. Third, Dillon's alibi was checked and he had witnesses proving that he was in San Francisco at the time of the murder. On the third point, though, there are those who claim otherwise, saying that it wasn't proven that he was in San Francisco between the 8th and 16th. The witnesses were unreliable. This has been debated, but let us assume that those who say that there's no proof that he was in San Francisco until the 17th, let's just say that they are correct. The fact that he was back in San Francisco after the murder still causes a problem. A package sent to the press containing all of her belongings that we talked about was posted from downtown LA when Leslie Dillon was definitely back at work in San Francisco. So again, that gives him an alibi for that as well. In 2018, Buzz Williams, a retired officer with California's Long Beach Police Department and the son of Richard F. Williams, part of the LAPD's gangster squad, told Rolling Stone that my dad thought Leslie Dillon was the killer, and that other cops suspected that he was at the very least an accomplice. Now, on the 40th anniversary of Elizabeth Short's murder, writer John Gilmore declared he had ultimately solved the Black Dahlia murder case and would share it all in an upcoming book, the first nonfiction book covering the case. So even though he declared this in 1987, it would be another 7 years before he finally released the book. The book was initially a huge success, and he claimed that Jack Anderson Wilson, also known as Arnold Smith, admitted he had killed Elizabeth Short during interviews with the man in 1981. That sounded like I said that he admitted to killing her during an interview. No, he was interviewing the guy who admitted to killing Elizabeth Short. You got that right. So Jack Anderson Wilson, he was an alcoholic. He was a petty criminal. And he actually died in a house fire a year after that. Now, the author, Gilmore, he says, oh, well, this was timely because Jack Anderson Wilson was about to be thoroughly investigated for the crime any day by a homicide detective named Jigsaw Jim St. John, all because of the information that Gilmore provided with this book. Unfortunately, the claims of John Gilmore didn't stand the test of time, with much of his book now dismissed as pure invention and fiction. The most damning evidence has been the non-existence in any records anywhere of the homicide detective he claimed had helped him investigate the Black Dahlia case. Other claims, such as Elizabeth Short having infantile genitalia, which was believed for years and still gets brought up today, were shown to be complete fabrications. Another author, Michael Newton, also disputed the claim that Detective St. John backed up Gilmore's theory of Jack Anderson Wilson being the killer. When interviewed by Newton, St. John dismissed Wilson as a suspect and rubbished the claim. Now, this guy Wilson has also been named as a possible suspect in the murder of someone by the name of Georgette Bardoff and the Cleveland Torso murders. The link with Bardoff, according to Gilmore, was that she knew Elizabeth Short and the two girls knew each other. This has since been proven to be false. Georgette had already been murdered before Elizabeth Short even arrived in L.A. And the Hollywood Canteen, where Gilmore claimed that they both worked together, had closed down by the time Elizabeth Short even arrived. And a Jack Wilson was mentioned as a possible suspect in the murder of one of the early victims in the Cleveland Torso series. However, when the murder took place in January of 36, Jack Anderson Wilson was only 15 years old at the time, and he would have only been 13 at the start of the killings. So it's probably safe to assume that Jack Wilson, the one that they were looking at the time, is a completely different Jack Wilson. Now, in 1996, George Knowlton became the latest to be named as the man responsible for the murder of Elizabeth Short in a book called Daddy Was the Black Dahlia Killer. Janice Knowlton, as you can guess from the book title, was the daughter of George Knowlton. And in 1989, she claimed that during therapy, she began to recover repressed memories of her father's violence. And eventually she had remembered Elizabeth Short as a victim of his brutality. Janice claimed her father, George Knowlton, and Elizabeth Short were having an affair, and she was staying in the garage of their family home. She also says that Elizabeth was also a prostitute, and she would bring in other young girls to be sold in a child sex trafficking ring. And Janice herself claims that she was sold as a child prostitute when she was 9 by her father. Janice says it went down like this. One night, Elizabeth suffered a miscarriage in the garage and was then murdered by George Knowlton. The body was cut up in the sink. Then when disposing of the body, he took his then 10-year-old daughter along for the ride to act as cover. According to Janice, he first tried dumping the body in the ocean, but when it failed to sink, he instead dumped the body in a vacant lot where it was found. So when Janice approached the police, they kind of dismissed this claim. Detective St. John said that the details that she gave had no relation to the facts. And if you kind of think about that, like her story and how everything goes, it really doesn't make sense. Like they cut her body and he cuts her body in half in a sink in the garage, or well, I guess the sink, who knows where the sink is. But first of all, hacking a body in half in a sink, and then you try to put it in the ocean, and then instead you just dump it in a lot. There would be evidence, I would think, that she was first attempted to be put in the ocean. Like they would find residue. The hair would look different if it was, you know, submerged in water. It just doesn't seem. And then, you know, just the manner of how it was laid out in a position. It wasn't just dumped because you couldn't dump it somewhere else. So, yeah, I don't agree with this one either. But Janice continued to campaign her story that her father was the killer, even making appearances on TV. She showed up on the Sally Jesse Raphael Show and Larry King Live. She released her book like 6 years after her, 6 years after she started making these claims. And after the book release, she continued to push her story on message boards and websites, often resulting in abusive rants at those who didn't believe her. Janice died March 6th of 2004 of an overdose, which was deemed a suicide, although her family members said that they think it was an accident. So little is known about George Knowlton himself. He died in an automobile accident in 1962, along with his young son, Kevin. Other relatives state he could have certainly been aggressive and abusive. And Janice's stepsister told the LA Times her book was trash and simply wasn't true, saying that their father, he could be mean, but he wasn't a killer. George Knowlton's name so far, he it's never come up in any reports. So I could have just been, I don't know where her mind was mentally, if she truly believed that, or if she was just trying to write a book and make a buck. Who knows? I don't know. Okay, move on. Let's move on to Walter Bailey. Bailey was a Los Angeles surgeon who lived one block south of the vacant lot where Short's body was found. And he lived there until he left his wife in October of 1946. His daughter was a friend of Short's sister, Virginia, and was even the maid of honor in her wedding. When Walter Bailey died in January of 1948, his autopsy showed that he was suffering from a degenerative brain disease. After his death, his widow said that his mistress knew a terrible secret about him, and because of that, the mistress was made the beneficiary when he died. Bailey was never a suspect in the case, but many medical doctors and others with medical training were. In secret testimony, Detective Harry Hansen, one of the original investigators, told the 1949 Los Angeles County Grand Jury that in his opinion, the killer was a top medical man and a fine surgeon. Bailey was 67 years old at the time of the murder, had no known history of violence or criminal activity of any kind, and is not known to have even met Elizabeth Short, even though his daughter was supposedly friends with Short's sister. So when Larry Harnish, who was a Los Angeles Times copy editor and writer, began studying the case in 1996, he concluded that Bailey could have been Elizabeth Short's killer. Critics of Harnish's theory question whether Bailey's mental and physical condition at the time of the murder would have been consistent with being able to carry out this type of crime. The original investigator's theory that the body was cut in half because the killer wasn't strong enough to move it, all in one piece, that kind of fits this situation, I guess. Harnish states that Bailey's brain disease contributed to his alleged violence against Short. Some have suggested that the secret that Bailey's mistress knew and she was blackmailing him was because he was performing abortions, which of course was a crime. But there's actually no evidence that Bailey or any of his associates were doing abortions. Now, when talking about the condition that Bailey had, his brain disease, it was actually known to produce violent behavior in otherwise passive individuals. So somebody who is, you know, a calm person with no violence could be affected by this brain disease and make them violent. And Bailey also had the surgical skills. He specialized in hysterectomies, mastectomies, surgical removal of fat. And in a conversation with Bailey's former receptionist, Harnish discovered that he and his mistress would, at dinner time, watch movies of surgeries and autopsies while they're eating. In this theory, Harnish actually consulted a retired FBI profiler, John Douglas, who advised that the very public location of the dump site was significant, since the killer had the ability to transport the body to a more remote site where it may not have been discovered. The site was one block away from the property owned by Bailey's ex-wife, Ruth, Douglas, the profiler, also said that the facial lacerations indicated personal anger towards the victim. Short would often falsely tell men that she had a son who had died tragically. And Bailey did, in fact, have a son who was struck by a car and killed at age 11. And this son's birthday was January 13th, and Short's body was found on January 15th. I don't know. I think that's kind of grasping at straws. But anyways, he was never actually a suspect, though. But there were a lot of suspects in this case. However, one name stands out more than any of the others as the supposed killer. The one that most people think was the actual killer. And that is a man by the name of George Hodel. Born in 1907 to wealthy Russian Jewish parents, George Hodel was raised in Pasadena as an indulged prodigy. At 9, he played major piano concerts. Handsome in a brooding, romantic way, he entered the California Institute of Technology at 14 and soon had an affair with a professor's wife, who bore his child. By the way, Hodel eventually fathered 11 children by 5 different people, 5 different women. I guess I didn't have to say people. Women's kind of obvious. Anyways, Hodel's teenage best friend was John Houston. Houston and Hodel sparred over a classmate, a delicate-faced and witty Dorothy Jean Harvey. But she eloped with Houston and became the first of his 5 wives, and they ran off to Greenwood Village in 1925. Meanwhile, Hodel, forced out of Caltech because of, you know, he knocked up the professor's wife, he started a literary magazine, became a photographer, attended the University of California, Berkeley, and went on to medical school. He began working for the Los Angeles Board of Health in 1938. His specialties were venereal diseases and secret abortions. Now, John Houston and Dorothy were back in Los Angeles, and they were divorced. So Hodel romanced Dorothy, and he renamed her Dorero, which is a combination of Dorothy and Eros. They ended up getting married in 1940, and Hodel bought a house on Franklin Street. It was designed by the son of Frank Lloyd Wright. Now, Hodel acquired a passion and interest in surrealistic art. And if you're not familiar with that style of art and surrealism, if you've seen Salvador Dali pictures, that's what that is. Like that dreamlike scenes, symbolic imagery, things like ordinary objects that are twisted, bizarre, distorted, different shapes. That's what that is. Now, there's some art historians that wrote this book. It was called Exquisite Corpse, Surrealism and the Black Dahlia Murder. And they say in that book, an interplay of irrationality, eroticism, and violence was at the heart of surrealism. So that's basically what that is. And when we learn a little bit more about George Hodel, you'll kind of see where that fits in. A surrealistic painter and photographer by the name of Man Ray had become captivated with sadomasochism while he was living in Paris. When he moved to LA in 1940, him and Hodel struck up a friendship and became very close. Now, in this house on Franklin Avenue, it was a lifestyle of self-indulgence, as well as frequent twisted sexual parties. And here is where a child made her unfortunate entrance into the world. In 1935, another Dorothy, Dorothy Anthony, a San Francisco model, gave birth to Hodel's daughter, Tamar. George brought my mother and me into his home, Tamar says. It was like a harem. Dorothy, Dorero, and, for a while, Hodel's common-law wife, Amelia, all with Hodel's children. "My father took avant-garde to the hilt, and the women went along with it," Tamar said, "but it was hidden." Tamar Hodel was one of six children by the three different women. She'd grown up in the Hollywood house, which resembled a Mayan temple, designed, like I said before, by Frank Lloyd Wright's son, and it was a site of wild parties. And when I say wild parties, they were more than just wild. It wasn't some wild frat party. It wasn't some, you know, just everybody getting drunk and crazy. There were a lot of twisted sexual sadomasochistic activities going on here. John Huston and Man Ray were often there. And Man Ray and Hodel, they shared a love of the work of the Marquis de Sade. And the Marquis de Sade was known for his sadomasochism, you know, the mix of sexual pleasure and pain. So in her father's home, Tamar recalls she often uncomfortably posed nude for what she called dirty old man, Man Ray, and had once wriggled free from a predatory John Huston, as well as George Hodel himself, committing incest with her. She says, "When I was 11, my father taught me to perform oral sex on him. I was terrified. I was gagging, and I was embarrassed that I had failed him," she says. Tamar says that she told her mother what George had done, and that when confronted, George denied it. He told her things like he was going to make her a woman when she was 16. He gave her books, sexually explicit books, kind of prepping her, I guess you could say. He didn't wait till she was 16 to make her a woman, though. When she was 14, he raped her. And to her horror, she became pregnant. And to her greater horror, she says, "My father wanted me to have his baby. But a friend took her to get an abortion." Once, an angry George, jealous of some boys who'd come to see her, struck her on the head with his pistol. After several months of enduring her father's possessive brutality, in 1949, Tamar got a warning from her stepmother. She, Dorero, it's just an odd name. It's an odd name to say. Dorero told me to run away. So I called my friends from high school, and they hid me. And because I was so afraid of my father and his power, they would move me from one location to a new location every 2 hours. Determined to repossess his daughter, George Hodel put out a missing persons report on Tamar, and in 3 days, the police found me. She was forced to tell the police about the incest, and in December of 1949, George Hodel was put on trial. With fear, but compelled under oath, 14-year-old Tamar told the truth. But George's high-priced Hollywood lawyers called the scared and trembling Tamar a troubled liar who had multiple boyfriends, which were lies. The defense team's strategy was to make her come across as unstable, a liar, and they just wanted to smear her name. Despite two witnesses who said that they had seen George forcing sex on his very young daughter, he was acquitted, and Tamar was sent to juvenile hall. Now, in juvenile hall, she was raped and had a baby at age 15. She named the baby Fauna. George Hodel, still controlling his daughter's life, placed the baby up for adoption with an African-American cleaning woman in Reno. Disturbingly enough, Tamar kept in touch with her dad even after the trial. This is a quote from her. She said, "If you're abused, you stay emotionally a little girl until someone helps you." Michelle Phillips, who is a singer of the Mamas and the Papas, was friends with Tamar, and according to actor Jack Nicholson, who dated Michelle Phillips, Michelle Phillips told him Tamar's story, It allegedly made its way into the script for the movie Chinatown. And get this, George's friend, John Huston, played the part of a father who rapes his daughter and makes her keep the baby. Tamar eventually moved to Hawaii and had three sons. So, 2 years before Hodell's trial is when the mutilated body of Elizabeth Short was found. Also, in May of 1945, Ruth Spalding, the secretary at Hodell's venereal disease clinic, and, of course, the keeper of many of his secrets, was found dead of an overdose. Police suspected it was forced, but they couldn't prove anything. So her death was ruled a suicide. Now, the biggest reason that we actually look at George Hodell as the guy comes from the 2003 book, Black Dahlia Avenger. And this book is by Hodell's son, who happens to be an ex-LAPD homicide detective. His name is Steve Hodell. And adding on to that is the book that I had mentioned before by the art historians Mark Nelson and Sarah Hudson Bayless, the one in 2006 called It's Exquisite Corpse. So according to the Black Dahlia Avenger, Hodell was the killer, and the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office conducted extensive surveillance of him. A striking graphic array of evidence in the two books strongly suggest that it was Hodell who, on January 15, 1947, killed actress Elizabeth Short, then surgically cut her in two and transported the nude corpse to a vacant lot where he laid the pieces out in a surrealistic artwork manner. Shortly after receiving the news of his father's death, Steve Hodell found himself sorting through his belongings. Though Steve's father, George Hodell, loomed large throughout his early childhood, their relationship was always strained. George was a grandiose doctor with a distant personality who abandoned the family shortly after Steve's 9th birthday and moved off to the Philippines. So as he's going through his father's possessions, Steve found a small photo album tucked away in a box. He looked into it. It was filled with the usual pictures: his mom, dad, brothers, as well as portraits of the family taken by the world-famous surrealistic artist Man Ray. But towards the back, something caught his eye. Two pictures of a young woman, her eyes cast downward, with curly, deep black hair. Steve still doesn't know why he had the idea, but as he looked at the images, he thought to himself, "My God, that looks like the Black Dahlia." Now, it did seem like a bit of a stretch, a connection between Short and Hodell. Here was one of the most brutal murders in American history, and after the Zodiac Killer shooting spree in San Francisco, perhaps the most famous unsolved crime in California. But from this moment on, Steve was hooked. In over 23 years, Steve rose through the ranks of the LAPD, established a reputation as an unfaltering homicide detective. So he had a good reputation, knew what he was doing, good cop, basically. So like any good cop, he started digging, and the details started to add up. So the crime scene photos show that Elizabeth Short had been given a hemicorporectomy, which is the procedure that slices the body beneath the lumbar spine, the only spot where the body can be severed in half without breaking bones. It was taught in the 1930s, when George Hodell had been in medical school. The letters sent to the press and police from the Black Dahlia Avenger, a man claiming to be Elizabeth Short's killer, also bore a chilling resemblance to his dad's handwriting. So obviously, like we had talked about before, I mean, he is not the first person who says that he is the child of Elizabeth Short's murderer. And he's not the first who's written a book on it. But he has dug up a hoard of evidence, including law enforcement files that show that his father topped the LAPD's list of suspects at the time of the crime. Law enforcement officials have mixed opinions about whether or not Steve Hodell is a brilliant vigilante or he's just an obsessive crackpot. But the fact is, no one has been able to prove him wrong. Steve began investigating his father with the same thoroughness of the good cop he'd always been. So he started from the beginning, started digging through witness interviews and newspaper archives. He filed a Freedom of Information Act to retrieve the FBI files on the murder and other information the Bureau had collected on his father. He sent the photographs that he found in his father's photo album to a facial recognition expert. Now, one of them remains unknown. The other one was identified as another woman. But the handwriting expert determined that there was a strong likelihood that his father's handwriting matched the script on some of the notes the killer sent to the LAPD. But the results were inconclusive. Now, in his digging, he also found a folder that contained receipts for contracting work on his childhood home. One of the receipts showed a purchase a few days before Short's murder of 10 5-pound bags of concrete, the same size and brand found near Short's body that police believe the killer used to carry her. Now, as a civilian, Steve doesn't have the access to the original police files, and as an officer admitted to him in his only meeting with the LAPD, the majority of the physical evidence has been lost over the years. Most of the witnesses are dead, as are the original cops that worked the case. And that's the problem when you're trying to dig up a case that is so old. But, you know, he recreated conversations that the dead cops had with friends, family members, and in one case, the daughter of a lieutenant's family dentist. A number of them reported hearing that the department believed the culprit was a doctor who lived on Franklin Avenue, where the Hodel family house was at the time of the murder. Steve tracked down a policewoman who reported seeing Short on the street with a man and a woman on the night before she was found. But half a century later, the cop could only remember what Short looked like. She had no idea. She couldn't remember what the other two people looked like. In 2001, after 2 years of researching the case full time, Steve Hodel turned to Stephen Kay, an acquaintance who worked in the LA County District Attorney's Office. Steve Hodel still wasn't sure if he could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that his father was the Black Dahlia killer, but he was convinced his investigation had unearthed enough new material to justify a fresh look from a law enforcement end. So, Kay, an assistant district attorney at the time, agreed to review Steve's work. 6 weeks later, Kay responded with a glowing letter. It said, "Thanks to some great detective work by his courageous son Steve, the name of Dr. George Hodel will live in infamy." He also added, "If George were still alive, he would file 2 charges of murder against him." Surprisingly, Kay believed Steve was right. Steve said when he had that, it was the moment where he said, okay, case solved. Now, Steve Lopez, a columnist at the Los Angeles Times, received a copy of Steve's book and decided to write about it. While he was fact-checking his column, Lopez asked the LA County District Attorney's Office for more information on the murder. The DA's office let him have access, and he came across a file that Lieutenant Frank Jemison, one of the original officers investigating the murder, had left behind in a safe in the basement of the district attorney's office. The file contains an assortment of photographs, newspaper clippings, and several hundred pages of typed interview notes. Buried in those notes is the bombshell that Steve had been hoping for. The Los Angeles Police Department was focused on 6 suspects in its Black Dahlia investigation, and George Hodel was on the list. And then there is the transcript of the period in 1950 when the police were bugging George Hodel's home. Most of the transcript is dull. Hodel had sex. He berates his secretary. He talks about money problems. But on February 19, 1950, there's a haunting exchange. This is what was caught. At 8:25 p.m., woman screams. Woman screams again. It should be noted, the woman not heard before the scream. Later in the day, Hodel talks to a confidant. Realize there was nothing I could do. Put a pillow over her head and cover her with a blanket. Get a taxi. Expired 12:57. They thought there was something fishy. Anyway, now they may have figured it out. Killed her. The surveillance continues. Routinely, but for one telling moment. Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead. Lopez's discovery of this file, the surveillance, the confirmation of his dad's place on the suspect list was a redeeming moment for Steve Hodel. Here you've got independent corroboration that he was in fact the prime suspect, he says. Basically, I was blown away. Now, George's obsession with the surrealistic art form and his relationship with Man Ray helped kind of propel some of this as well. There's actually two of Man Ray's photographs, Le Amoureux and The Minotaur, and they bear a chilling resemblance to Short's mutilated body. Short's body, Steve argues, was George's way of emulating his friend's surrealism, allowing him to build what Steve calls a masterpiece, a crime so shocking it would endure. To my dad, the Black Dahlia is his story. If there's any kind of noteworthiness in his life, it probably came from this. This is kind of his calling card at this point, so yeah, I can see how you would want it to be as grand as possible. Steve also says that for him, the Black Dahlia case is like a loose thread in a sweater. You tug on it gently, thinking you've come to the end, and it continues to unravel. There has never been a comfortable end point to conclude his investigation. Each piece of evidence leads to another, in turn leading to another crime. So George Hodel is the one that is looked at by most as the one who is the actual Black Dahlia killer. And I'm going to agree with that theory. I think that's probably the most likely out of all of those suspects. So, over 70 years later, a case with so many suspects, so many scenarios and possibilities, but never an actual conviction, no closure in this case, no resolution, and no peace for Elizabeth Short. So there you have it. One of the most infamous Hollywood crimes. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed that one. I sure did. That is one of my favorite unsolved mysteries. One of my favorite crime stories, for sure. I always like the unsolved ones. They're more intriguing. It's like once you find out who did it, it's not as interesting. I don't know, maybe it is. That's just what I think. Anyways. So anyways, I'm out of here, guys. Make sure you follow me on Facebook and Instagram. And you can always contact me at followthedarkpodcast@gmail.com. But have a great one, guys. Thank you again for joining me. It was fun. It was a good one. Let me know what you thought. Throw me out some ideas if there's something you want to hear in particular. And until next time, stay dark, my friends.